Right, well, good evening, everybody. Comrades, friends, ladies and gentlemen. I'll actually stand to show my respect to everybody. I feel better standing and talking. Can you hear me? We'll just try and... is this the main mic? Can I be heard this way? Right at the back? Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to express my gratitude, my appreciation to the organisers of this Israel Apartheid Week here in Canada, here in Montreal, in Ottawa, Toronto and Vancouver. So I've got quite a few miles to travel this week in this extraordinary country. I have actually just come from the UK, where I was involved in the activities there. I've noticed that somebody who, in a sense, while I was a minister up until September of last year, would have been something of a colleague of mine, ministerial colleague from across the seas, whatever the nature of particular countries, as ministers visiting each other, we're always colleagues and respect one another and so on. And I want to say to your Minister of Immigration, the Honourable Minister Kenny, that I'm certainly quite sure, given the discussions I've been having since yesterday evening when I arrived and today with the organisers of this week, actually Palestinian, Jewish, Canadians, people from Iran and other countries amongst them, that I'm perfectly sure that the activities are beneficial and that they are not an effort, in his words, to perhaps cloak hatred with intellectual pretense. And that we're talking about something extremely serious. Whichever side we might come from, to try and pursue through a dialogue when it comes to the questions, an interrogation of the situation, a situation which affects many people throughout the world, not just those living within the Middle East theatre. And I'll come to that in due course. But you know, if I may, with your indulgence, actually start with a quotation this evening. I think it's very apt in this Israeli Apartheid Week. And it's a quotation that a South African, quite a well-known South African, made back in 1961. And this person said that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. 1961, all those decades ago. And this wasn't at the time of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. 1961. I don't know if there's anybody here who might provide the answer. I didn't hear? Nelson Mandela, it was not. Walter Sisulu, it was not. Chris Hani or Joe Slovo. It was Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who had done his thesis in psychology, philosophy, in Nazi Germany, as a lot of his colleagues had, and who were sympathizers, such Nazi sympathizers that quite a number were rounded up and interred during the Second World War. It was Verwoerd who said this in dead earnest, and he said it, friends, ladies and gentlemen, because he was experiencing such frustration that here South Africa was being lampooned internationally. Well, to him, he wouldn't care what the Asians or the Africans or those communists behind the Iron Curtain were saying. But in the Western world, and in fact by part of South African white society, English orientation, and the media, attacking this concept of apartheid. He was annoyed that a certain prime minister from Britain had the previous year come out to South Africa and lectured them about the winds of change sweeping through Africa, which would surely affect the situation in South Africa and the racism there. There had been a massacre of black people earlier in 1960 at Sharpeville in March, 49 years ago, in which 69 human beings had been cut down, defenseless people, civilians, men, women, some children. And there was an eruption and revulsion internationally for South Africa and apartheid. And yet, there's this state called Israel, which had come into inception in the very same year that Verwoerd's party won the South African general election. Up until that time, you all know the name of Jan Christian Smuts, the old leader of South Africa, very close to the British, who had ruled a racist colonial state, to be sure, but without the excesses of apartheid. And he just couldn't understand how this place, state of Israel, was treated as verily the light unto the nations, which the founding fathers, Zionist founding fathers, had said in a brave way that that's what Israel would become, a light unto the nations. So Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state, 1960. Therefore, this isn't a manufacture of a one-sided, hate-filled group of people, critics of Israel within South Africa and internationally, who are trying to slag off a state that is not racist. Verwoerd was well acquainted with the world's politics and was a very keen student of developments. So how does he come to view, never being there far off, Israel is an apartheid state like South Africa? Now, of course, there's been a great deal of emotion wrapped up in the land of Israel, and we know the reason. Anti-Semitism through the ages, which the Jewish people had faced, the abomination of the Holocaust, the victims from those dreadful camps, and a Zionist movement only created in 1897 in a formal sense. Already from 1880s there had been some stirrings and development. But here you have from afar the realization, his acknowledgement, his understanding of racist state like apartheid. And you see what is held in common is the question of a race exclusivity, the opposite of inclusivity of people, that Dr. Verwoerd is preaching in South Africa under apartheid, that this is the white man's land. The white man came here to South Africa three centuries before, middle of the 17th century. And our history books, which I had to study as a kid, and were studied by our kids right up to the democracy, 1990, when the ban was lifted on the ANC, and then 1994 was our big democratic election, is that South Africa's an empty land. Bees and butterflies and birds. That these black masses, tribes, never nations, tribal people, were coming across the northern border, which is Limpopo River with Zimbabwe, more or less at the time when the first settlers are arriving in the Cape from Holland, Dutch. The Brits came a little later, around about 1800, 1820, the influx. So here you have that same analogy, and you all have heard about Palestine into the 20th century, has heard it all the time as a kid, growing up, putting my money in the Zionist collection boxes, and learning Hebrew at Hebrew school. The land without a people, or people without land. Same ideological comparisons. The question of a lord of real estate, a property lord, who was saying to these white South Africans, the Afrikaner, they invoked the Old Testament. They looked to the Israelites and saw themselves in the same guise. That the God was giving them this land, this wilderness, and the command to come and civilize it. And they had a covenant with the Lord who would deliver their enemy into their hands. And they would lord it over this country. And of course, Favut was seeing the parallel with the ancient Israelites and the same biblical mythology. The early Zionists were in the main from Russia, that empire, Poland, and so on. And they were largely agnostics, even atheists. They weren't concerned with the Bible in terms of a belief, but used it and very skillfully. They were in conflict with the rabbis of the time. You know the story about the three rabbis of Vienna, who after the first founding congress in 1897 were very doubtful about the Zionist enterprise. And they, good people that they were, inquiring, wanting to see things for themselves, they decided to journey to the promised land, then under Turkish rule. And they sent a cable, a telegram, back home to the congregation. The bride is indeed beautiful, but unfortunately already married. And I came across that in Avri Schlamm's book on the Iron War. It hit me between the eyes. And if you think about that very pertinent observation, and you begin to realize that, in fact, the whole story is one of colonial settlement and then using a Zionist doctrine new to the Jews at that stage. They had to be proselytized with this. And it's been about settlement, as in South Africa, dispossession, displacement of an indigenous people, usurping the groom's role with the bride, the land, and seizing that, and then holding on using any measures and methods available and justifying it all, like Benny Morris, the revisionist historian, who found the first to get into the records in the 1980s and found and wrote about this awful happening in 1947, 48, 49. It took place with the birth of Israel. The destruction of the villages, the use of terror to frighten people, even massacres like at Deir Yassin, 240 people, men, women and children killed, and throwing people onto vehicles or just marching them down the roads and into exile as refugees. Now, you think Dr. Favut didn't know about this. He was a very keen student of politics and of history. And South Africa had gone that route, just like the pioneers of the Americas, of North America, going west. The genocide against Native Americans, what the British did in Australasia against the Aboriginals. The black population of Africa was very strong, dense in number, etc. But in places like Namibia, people were wiped out by German colonialism. In the Congo, by King Leopold and his whole enterprise there. So, of course, people who have gone through an experience in this world of ours can see whether we come from the Favudian side or from the liberation side, based on the quest for justice, a belief in equality, fairness for people, can see what is what. And will want to follow the age-old exhortations of a Robbie Burns, the Scottish bard, who would write centuries ago how man never ceases to be appalled by the inhumanity of man to man, and humanity mourns that inhumanity. Or in the South African struggle sense, where our slogan was, an injury to one is an injury to all. Or for me, a wonderful saying I came across in a beautiful city in the southern part of Iran called Shiraz, where two great Persian poets are buried. Hafez of Shiraz is called, and Sa'di. And Sa'di on the tomb is the statement. Is the statement that just as with the human body, if you experience pain, even in the fingertip, the whole body feels the discomfort. And he says the same applies to the human race. That any people experiencing such trauma must infect the whole of humanity. It's like Nelson Mandela saying to us, and as he said to Yasser Arafat, when he came to South Africa in 1998 on a visit and made the point to the whole of South Africa that we South Africans can't feel free as long as the Palestinians are not free. So there is that sharing of the suffering. And it doesn't mean that the people you're concerned about have to live just across the river or behind the mountain. Mandela said to South Africa, in his first main speech as the president that we South Africans must ensure support for far-off East Timor, for West Sahara, and for Palestine. So, of course, when we find opposition in South Africa, as we do, it's a democracy. People can express themselves as long as there's no violence. So when those in South Africa, who I might call a Zionist lobby, attack us as to why we're so concerned about Palestine and not Zimbabwe, see, one can refer to that speech of Mandela's about East Timor and so on. And of course, then they shut up because there's no way they want to be heard of accusing Mandela of being an anti-Semite. But one thing I've noticed about these people is that when we speak about a struggle or a people of our choice, because verily, there are many, many peoples around the world with difficulties, under oppression, their feudal kingdoms, people have their hands cut off and the like. Women are stoned to death if they are adulterers and so on. It's up to one's own choice in this. But what I've noticed in such attacks is that they assume, because you're speaking on Palestine, that you haven't stood up for other struggles. And certainly we of the South African Liberation Movement, and it goes for all of us throughout our lives, have constantly stood up against anti-Semitism, against the coup in Chile, or the colonel's coup in Greece, Vietnam, and countless other such inhumane and barbaric acts. But to continue on the way which we have viewed Palestine, Israel, from afar or close, you see, note the date of Dr. Favut's statement, 1960, December 23rd, actually. And there were no occupied territories. He was talking about Israel itself. He was talking about those living within Israel itself. The 20%, as we know today, the number today, of Palestinians and the non-Jews, Christians or Muslims, non-believers, whatever. And he could see that the logic of creating a state that's not inclusive of all the people, but excludes, that then you're on the same road as apartheid. Because then you've got to start defining everybody and you must make it known in their books of identity or their passports. And we had this most hated system in South Africa. It's like akin to the Nazi involvement in documentation and putting in Jood or whatever. So South African books had all that. And we see that with the documentation within Israel, it's got to show whether you're Jewish or not. And out of this comes a whole rank of laws, as with apartheid South Africa, which is about where you live, your property rights, your trading rights, access to services? Is your little village recognized as a municipality so that it can benefit from the fiscus and the municipal laws? You speak to Palestinians within Israel and how many of their villages and neighborhoods are not attended by the municipal service factor. You know quite well what was going on in Northern Ireland, I'm sure. Was that one of the major issues there was the disparities between Catholic and Protestant, with the Catholics as second-class citizens, education, health, the local municipal services, and of course this is South Africa. And you see access to the military and the security, police and intelligence services also, as in South Africa, until they were desperate and started bringing in blacks as cannon fodder, actually, troops but not officers. So in Israel, if you're Palestinian, you're not going to be a member of this vast institution whose membership opens up for you the most incredible privileges, including the kind of pension that you will receive and all the access for health and psychological treatments and so on. Well, Dr. Verwoerd began to implement this grand design of apartheid. And of course it soon meant the demolition of houses. It soon meant that the military trucks were arriving in what they called the black spots, where African indigenous black people, those of mixed race color, those of Asian, largely Indian origin, lived, traded, had amenities that they had built up. And of course, white business actually prized these areas. And they were the black spots, and the people were forcibly ejected. Not quite out of South Africa. They needed the labor power. They had the reserves, which they then termed the Bantu stones. And these were very far away. But that's where they kept the reserve labor, the reserve army of labor. They removed people in this ruthless manner. And of course, in the process, as people resisted and threw stones or firebombs and tried some form of resistance, of course, they were beaten down, shamboked, battened, and at times shot. So the repression, of course, was breeding a resistance. And that's what happens everywhere. But the Bantustans really, by the 60s, in a huge momentum. And they were developing these Bantustans. No one country and system is the same as another. And certainly, when one looks at what is happening to the Palestinian population or the Arab peoples of Israel itself, what one has noted in the Zionist project from the time of Theodor Herzl, in his own words, "What will you do with these Arabs?" And in his own words, "We will spirit this penniless population across the borders and out of Israel." With apartheid, that wasn't the case. They wanted to keep within the country this reserve army of labor. When, with a South African delegation, we visited President Yasser Arafat in 2004 in his bombed-out headquarters in Ramallah, The building had a couple of rooms which were intact, where he lived with 20 or so of his aides. And we sat at a table, and from somewhere or other they performed the most wonderful lunch. And we'd been travelling around, so now we were meeting, result of our experiences. And he said with large eyes, "Now do you see the Bantustan that they've consigned us to?" So I said, "Well, you see, President, it's not a Bantustan." And there was a hushed silence. Everyone was wondering, what on earth is this guy going on about? And I said to President Arafat that, "Well, you see, in all that history of the Bantustans, there was never a single occasion that a South African military aircraft bombed any of these Bantustans, or tanks. They never went in with cannons blazing. And in fact, when you travelled around South Africa into these godforsaken areas, you could only realise that you were coming to the Bantustan when the tarmac road had started running out and the terrain was getting barren. And if you were looking carefully out the window, you would just glimpse, as you flashed past, a sign which said you are now entering the Transkei, Ciskei, Venda, Maputswana, and so on. And you see, Mr. President, what Verwoerd was doing was putting in funds. They were investing. And they were building palaces for their Mickey Mouse Bantustan placemen, and government and justice buildings for them, and even airports with the Bantustan airline. And they had their legations, their missions in Pretoria. And if any country internationally was prepared to recognize them, there were one or two places that actually had a Maputswana consulate. And certainly in London, they had a trade mission. So by then, the eyes of everybody there had widened to maximum. And it just reminds us that whatever we thought of our racist rulers, this level of duplicity and hypocrisy, you see, what they were racists, and they were willing to say so. And they felt that you could justify racism, because in the good Dr. Verwoerd's words, everybody must develop along their own specific lines. And they were saying, we are serious about it. We're putting money into the Bantustans in order that these places should function. So there are similarities indeed, but there are also very, very big differences. There's an element that hit South Africans so forcefully when we visit, as many South Africans do, the occupied territories, Gaza and the West Bank. And we recoil with horror as we see the conditions under which people have been subjected, with the apartheid, the separation wall, with the barbed wire, with the sieges, and I'm not just talking about this last 18 months or more of Gaza. Around every small town and locality, locked in ghettos like Kilkilia in the north, which is just like the ghettos of the Middle Ages in Europe, where people were locked in at night, and where the kids have to wait for the soldiers to come and unlock the door so that they can go to a school which is somewhere else. And we see it with our own eyes. And the people in those long, long queues, these lines at the checkpoints, taking hours for them, which would have been a journey in the past of 10 minutes or so. And that's what we grew up with in South Africa. The kind of thing that used to affect me was simply seeing such a lack of municipal amenities for blacks that you'd come out of school and you would see late afternoon, 5 p.m. or whatever, right until 7 p.m., these lines of African workers and old mothers and so on at these bus stops waiting to get back to the townships. It's something that is extremely moving to any South African. Which is why, ladies and gentlemen, when Archbishop Tutu had gone to Palestine in the late 1990s, he made the statement that the conditions under which the Palestinians are being ruled makes what South Africans experience like a child's play, like a picnic. And anybody, certainly in the first place, those involved in any way with our liberation struggle, have said this and seen it, and many, many more younger people. We've got a whole project through the South African Council of Churches of young people. They send half a dozen to live in the occupied territories, West Bank. Normally some men had been in Gaza for like 6 months at a time, and they have a rotation and they live with the people and they see what's happening, and they come back and they say, but what's happening there is far worse. And I'm talking about a period where none of us, I'd been there a few times, I've never seen bombs actually dropping on people or the shooting. These dreadful scenes that we see on TV that have been upsetting people throughout the world and which have been going on and on. And we've seen this in the history, and including the history more and more written by Israeli writers, because you see the Palestinians had their narrative and they had their writers. So what I'm talking about in terms of Tom Segev, Ilan Pappe, Benny Morris, Avri Shaim and so on, perhaps the kind of literature that in the Western world we get more easily, and the Palestinian narrative from 48 is redolent with all of this. And then we grow up and we see what happened in 67 and in the first and then the second Intifada and the Lebanon and Gaza at the turn of the year, Christmas and into the new year. But you know, as South African liberation cadre, we had seen South Africa behaving within the whole of Southern Africa the way Israel has behaved in its neighborhood. So that in 1967, the new Prime Minister of Israel, the one who had been interred during the war by Smuts, Balthazar Johannes Foster, he was getting very concerned about the extent to which the liberation movement of Southern Africa were getting support from the very poor, lacking in resources, black African states of the region. And he saw what Israel had done, and he said, Israel has dealt with the Arab states, talking obviously Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and so on, had been dealt with by lunchtime. We will eat the African states for breakfast. So there's a growing affinity which becomes a veritable axis, 1973 October War, when Israel, the first, only time it's been beaten as such, in that case, Egypt, is in dire straits, is a big crisis. Of course, it's got America assisting. But South Africa had particular weaponry which it was able to provide at a moment's notice. And that created a synergy between Pretoria and Tel Aviv, which we called the Israel-South Africa axis. And South Africa benefits, the apartheid South Africa, which in the coming years is going to find tremendous difficulty as sanctions bite, and particularly the arms sanction, and Israel in turn can come to its assistance with assisting South Africa build up an arms industry virtually from scratch. South Africa used to import everything. Build this up and get major weaponry, its naval craft, its supersonic jet fighters, which with Israeli technology they had taken growingly obsolete Mirage F1s into an update supersonic, various forms of rocketry, everything across the boards, and including to help this apartheid state develop and own 6 nuclear weapons, which the moment we came to power we had dismantled. This is a game which a state which in 48 many parts of the world regarded in high esteem, Martin Buber, Hannah Arendt, Einstein, they looked at it in an idealistic way and hoped that indeed it would radiate as a light unto the nations. And this is what a Zionist Israel, it's not Jewish people, ladies and gentlemen. We saw this with apartheid. It's a system of apartheid that infected its people with race notions out of what appeared to the good Dr. Verwoerd to be a benign thing, just basically saying, you know, race is what counts and race purity. And we used to say in our struggle, as we say to those involved as protagonists in the Middle East, that ours was not a struggle about skin color. It was not about pushing the whites into the sea. Rivals of the African National Congress try and get support. They projected that. That's the Pan-Africanist Congress, incidentally. But that we had a common struggle and a common objective to create equality in our country so that all could benefit as equals. So it's a system. And for myself, coming from Jewish origins, and I'm not claiming, you see, that I'm devout or anything of that nature, but I have a background. And I went through Hebrew school and had the rites of passage and the bar mitzvah and so on. And to see, along with many Jews, within Israel, growing number, and internationally, the kind of warning that Einstein made with Hannah Arendt in a famous letter to the New York Times in December 1948, when Menachem Begin of the Irgun came to raise money in New York, and they said, "This man's a fascist. He's a Nazi, he's dangerous, don't have anything to do with them." and after the Lebanon issue, an aggression against the Lebanon. And I'll come to the question of the excuses they give when I deal with resistance. That I came across that statement in this book of Sizling, who was the first Israeli Minister of Agriculture. And this is Avi Shlaim and Tom Segev, and you can find it, you just Google Aharon Sizling, C-I-Z-L-I-N-G, who hears about Da'ir Yassin. And it comes about into the open because of what Einstein and Hannah Arendt are writing about. This is a good 6 months later. And he says of Da'ir Yassin and the other massacres, because there were the number that's recorded now by Ilan Pappe and other researchers is 34. There's a Palestinian accounts come to 40 in that 48 period. And Aharon Sizling says that now we too have behaved like Nazis and my whole being is shaken. And I see a very right-wing Labour Member of Parliament, Gerald Kaufman, who when I lived in London knew something about, because we were very involved in mobilising on the Vietnam issue. And he was Harold Wilson's press officer. And he used to attack us in a vicious way. He's a great friend of Israel. But through the years, it's been eroded. He's not turning against the Jews. He's a fellow Jew. He's not involved in self-hate or a traitor. He's actually wanting to help the Jews in Israel and elsewhere. And he made a comment about this spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force, who was fielding all those questions about this inhumanity and the massacre, the killings of women, of children in Gaza. And she had just tossed it aside, collateral damage and so on. And, you know, it had to happen because these Hamas people, they hide amongst the masses. And we are the most humane military in the world because we send people, your victims, you send them the SMSs on the mobile. And Kaufman says, this woman talks like a Nazi. So how does one make sense of this? I can tell you, I wrestle with it myself. I am very passionate about this issue as a human being, as someone who's involved in the South African freedom struggle and feels the need for solidarity. Not as a Jew who's just embarrassed and I've got to come and find friends who are Muslims, but because I'm a human being and I'm very concerned. And I must say that for a people who suffered the abomination, the unspeakable abomination of the Holocaust, which affected me as a kid growing up and hearing the stories in the background, that my understanding of Judaic value and what I picked up from my parents and my neighborhood, was a very Jewish one in Johannesburg, it was about sanctity of life and concern of people, and what a great Jewish sage many centuries back, Hillel, was stating, that you must treat others as you would wish them to treat you, or you mustn't deal with others in the way you would not wish them to deal with you. I'm trying to get it absolutely correct because I wrote this once in a paper and the Zionist immediately attacked me saying, well, it wasn't that way, it was the inverse way. Fine. It's got the same meaning to me. It's about you don't treat people in the way that you wouldn't want to be treated yourself. So, of course, as a non-believer, as someone who's become involved in a universal, not in my own tribe, wanting to see the people that I spring from being what they had been in the past, people who the world could look up to as bringing great gift and science and knowledge and beauty to the world, a real light unto others, not the kind of light that brings the unspeakable death that is caused by the new weapons of destruction, mass destruction, used against civilian populace that we saw in the Lebanon and now refined from there in Gaza. And you speak to those wonderful Israeli Jews who belong to the Physicians for Human Rights, Israeli Physicians for Human Rights. And when I was in London, I spent several hours with Colin Green, who is one of the gurus of this from the medical side and works with them all the time. And he was explaining to me exactly how these weapons of death, the effect. We had heard in the press, the media, it was a breakthrough, white phosphorus, what it does to the human body. White phosphorus, which that IDF spokesperson first said, we do not use anything that's illegal. But the white phosphorus, in fact, is a weapon, and I speak as a former Deputy Minister of Defence and somebody who is in his intelligence minister. You mustn't worry about the kind of people who are filming us. In South Africa under apartheid, we had this from the Zionist lobby. The South African equivalent was our secret police, just like they had in the Gestapo days, where they wanted to record and photograph everything and every word that was said. So have pity on somebody who's got that kind of job. But the white phosphorus is meant to be, in terms of the rules of law of war, a weapon that you use not even against soldiers, enemy soldiers on the battlefield. You use it in a situation where your own troops are cornered and there's no way out, and you need to put down a very effective smoke screen. And that's when you're supposed to drop these white phosphorus bombs. You see, Al Jazeera caught them out, showing you that these things, this abomination, this grotesque weapon, was being dropped on the built-up civilian areas, urban areas of Gaza. And when you speak to doctors who actually see the result, and Green was explaining to me, of course, when it hits the body, it immediately melts through and gets into the body itself, through the skin. And in many cases, people coming there with this are given some superficial dressing for burns and sent home. But what's happening is that the white phosphorus inside the body is eating away. And when the surgeons get to this, because of what's happening, and they open the body, so the fire breaks out again, and surgeons have their hands burnt. And the kids, very often kids it was, and the fire erupts again. So the white phosphorus is one of these weapons they're using, together with the cluster bombs that they dropped on Lebanon, which is actually a weapon of mass destruction, and it's to make the lives of civilians absolutely impossible in the fields. The Americans had used this. It was used in Lebanon. The kids tend to be the victims, and this again is what's been dropped there. But they're new weapons, weapons which throw out darts and razor splinters, and inert radium-tipped artillery and the like. So it's absolutely correct that there's a clamour rising now that those responsible for this onslaught, the politicians and the military people, must be brought to account. And that's in terms of crimes against humanity and war crimes. Now, I have indicated that there is a little question of resistance and the right to resist. You know, you hear in North America, we know of a famous revolution, your big next-door neighbor to the south extol their culture with this idea of the right to bear arms and the right to raise your arms against tyranny and repression and the American Revolution. Well, this is a universal. This is what drove the South African struggle and the anti-colonial movement throughout the world, from Vietnam to Mozambique, Angola, etc. A people's right to take up weapons and to fight against occupation or to fight against tyranny. And sometimes in that situation, you know, people don't necessarily use the best possible tactics. There are those who say it should only be non-violent, and Gandhi tried that, and the South Africans tried that until Sharpeville. And we see the Palestinian civil society talking that language, and that's very good. But, and we hope that they can succeed that way. But people have the right to resist. And this was the case in South Africa, as it's been the case even for the Israelis or the Jewish movement, certainly in occupied Europe against the Nazis. And this, of course, is what the Irgun and Haganah and Stern Gang, they all claim that. And, of course, they didn't balk at using terrorism. They were the ones who first utilized it within the Palestinian theater. We don't, as South Africans, advocate the use of terrorism in the sense of terrorism being the indiscriminate attack on non-combatants, on civilians. But in relation to this, the rockets, homemade instruments from Gaza, which purportedly are the reason for the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, going in. And this has been going on for 10 years, and in 10 years they've killed 20 people. This is the number. In the last year of the truce, the six-month truce, two people died, and then during the war itself, another three civilians. We know that nine or ten died, probably three or four from actual bullets, others from friendly fire or whatever. So this question of proportionality is an issue which, of course, people raise. And the Human Rights Commission around the world and the UN have said, well, Hamas shouldn't have been firing the rockets. But the question really is, what is the root core reason for the resistance, and we South Africans who fought apartheid? And there were cases when civilians died through our actions, and there were cases where the masses took action, which was not very nice and which was blamed on us, and in a moral sense we were the ones who were fueling, motivating, inspiring the struggle. Nobody internationally took that as the reason for accepting that apartheid could mow down the black people of South Africa willy-nilly. So if we have any lessons for the Israelis, and we've said this to them, Deputy Minister of Defense, I interacted with Israeli defense attachés in our country, and the ambassador then, who at that stage wasn't too bad a guy. Understand the question of resistance and what creates it. You should know this. You should know it from the Warsaw Ghetto, that when you repress a people, and this is history shows it, repression generates resistance. And unfortunately in that, those who stand up to fight back and have very little resources can very easily resort in quite a rough manner, to say the least, which happened in the streets of South Africa. But again, is it a just cause? Is it a just struggle? Is it legitimate struggle? And certainly, through the eyes of Mandela and Tutu, we see the Palestinian cause as a just cause and a legitimate cause. I'll come now to get to the end and say that if we're still following my approach here, my presentation, and what can we learn from the South African struggle, and there's lots that the Israeli people and government can learn, but it's that element of our struggle which helped to make a decisive change in the situation, which helped to bring about the end of apartheid. And mind you, the end of apartheid benefited not just blacks, it benefited all our people, including whites. And there were members of the white tribe, white elite, who said, and say to this day, that they found themselves liberated because a just society was created. And that is the campaign run by the anti-apartheid movement, which was established in 1959. So it took 30 years. It's a tough uphill battle, and it's not an easy route. But it's one in which, on the request of the people of South Africa and the ANC, we asked for support, and you see, support of a moral kind, people making statements and declarations is very good, and it helps. It helps to show people who are suffering that they're not alone, and that there are people out in the world who understand the justice of their cause. But when you can take your statements, your declarations, a stage further, and when you can help to really make a difference, then humanity becomes part and parcel of the struggle to end apartheid, the struggle to end the system in Israel which has consigned the Palestinians to this dreadful suffering and which is abusing the Jewish people in their morality and their religion through Zionism, which is not the friend of the Jewish people, but in fact its enemy. And the solidarity movement took form of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS, that this week is about, and you will hear from Omar Baghouti, who is the absolute driving force, not the only. There's an army of people. And we have to say that, otherwise there have been a lot of Palestinians who are targeted for removal, as used to be the case with South Africa. And you will hear so much about it from him. But I can tell you from the South African point of view that in terms of our struggle, we saw this as an absolute formidable element of struggle that helped to isolate apartheid South Africa and helped to isolate its political and military elite, who were constantly seeking the support of their white population and were constantly befuddling them and brainwashing them into belief that unless they stood together and accepted any measures of that political military elite, that their throats would be cut or they'd end up in the sea. So this boycott, divestment and sanctions gathered its momentum and helped to isolate apartheid South Africa more and more. It also helped to bring about a mind shift amongst the white South African public, who were filled with race hate on the basis of their brainwashing. And at first, the people who were talking abroad and were motivating for this were the real hate figures, and the people who were disturbing this population in their sleep and then their pleasures. And they couldn't go and see the latest Royal Shakespeare plays in South Africa because that was not going to come to South Africa anymore. And in their blessed rugby and cricket, this as a religion to the Afrikaners particularly was something which was prevented. You know, the extent to this is something I had forgotten until a few weeks ago only. I was watching a documentary on South African television about our wonderful rugby team and history, even through the racist period. And they were showing the South African rugby team in New Zealand in something like 1965-66. And this team, every single place it went in New Zealand, a little village and a little town, you know, by rail and bus, they had to stop as though they were royalty. And that entire community would be out hailing them and clapping them and so on. And then it shows something like 12 years later, 15 years later, they come to New Zealand and they're treated like lepers. And there's a massive mobilization of the police to prevent any interference, which became impossible. That was passive resistance on behalf of the demonstrations and very disciplined. But they would come onto the rugby fields and they would prevent the game taking place. So it had to be abandoned. But the thought that struck me then was the extent to which the attitudes of the New Zealand population, you know, they're not very radical people, probably rather like white South Africans and goody-goody Canadians and, you know, English men and women who like to play according to the Queensbury rules. And here was this whole society absolutely up in arms and sitting down, preventing the bus taking the Springboks from their hotel and moving them, etc., etc. Right, a little bit of fracas. But what it did in terms of the greater good of bringing a swifter end to apartheid, of changing the mindset, and incidentally inspiring the people, the oppressed people of South Africa, and encouraging the small band of whites who broke the myth, the racial myth, which said all of the tribe would be together against the black hordes. We see the same with Israel. We see these gallant Jewish citizens of Israel, 500 now, who have actually signed to endorse the BDS program. And those like Jack Halpin and others of the against the house demolitions and so on, coming to the fore. So for the Palestinians, as it had been for the South Africans, I come to a conclusion now that it looks very grim, and it looks as though you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. But by resolve, by determination, by correct strategies of mobilization, and for the Palestinians, as was the case with us, the essential aspect of a national unity and not division, because you can't get anywhere without that. And this enormous groundswell now, given Gaza, there's been an absolute sea change, that people at last are beginning to see the Zionist project for the racist project that it is, that we sense this change. And you see, when 150,000 Palestinians living within Israel in the Galilee and the north, together with a sprinkling of Jews, demonstrates in the streets of Israel against what was happening in Gaza and showing their national consciousness, then you realize that things are changing. When Jewish women in Toronto stage a sit-in at the Israeli consulate, then there's something really happening. When tram drivers in Oslo, Norway, decide to stop the trains just for 2 minutes in protest at what Israel has done in Gaza, then you realize that attitudes are changing. When the students of Hampshire College in the USA, the first college historically in the USA to get the divestment from apartheid, do it again, and now Cardiff in the UK, and the campus activities such as this, which are disciplined and peaceful and inquiring, you realize that there's a momentum, because this is now taking place. This week that started in Canada is now taking place in 40 countries around the globe. And ladies and gentlemen, when in Durban, South Africa, the dock workers refused to offload a ship of Israeli cargo, then you know that the current is running in a very strong way and in the right direction. And those who complain now, and I've seen this president of the Hillel College or Association saying, no, the arguments are all skewed and there's bias and condemning what you're doing. You've got to ask this poor guy the question. You know, what was he complaining in the past? Is he quite happy in all these years? It's only now that people are really beginning to sit up and take note. Not because students and adults and workers and faith groups are taking action on the basis of what Saadi had to say, Saadi of Persia, but because they are revolted by the manner in which Israel is ruthlessly dealing with the Palestinian people. So certainly, let's not have this business any longer, and it's so worn out that it's becoming absolutely passé, and that is that if one is critical of Zionism or Israel, it means you're anti-Semitic. And I say to my acquaintances and sometimes my friend and even my family in South Africa, you see, when you keep crying wolf, wolf, it's anti-Semitic, anti-Semitic, when there's the real anti-Semitism, that fascist Nazi type, it's got nothing to do with this movement, which is a movement that wants to see justice, peace and security for all those people living in the Middle East, Christian and Muslim and Jew. That when you go on like this, when, as Brecht said in a memorable poem, the bitch is on heat again, in reference to a rise of fascism, then you must be very careful. You find yourself in a situation where people not believe you and where you're isolated. And do you know, if that happened, the people who are supporting the Palestinians, including the Palestinians themselves, in my knowledge and my experience, will be the first people who will stand up against that kind of real anti-Semitism. So, I bring you all from far off South Africa, our fraternal greetings, our solidarity, our support, our admiration for the Canadian movement, for the way you're organizing. I see the discipline, I see the conscientiousness, I see how you're imbued with an absolute positive spirit and a spirit of construction and of building. And I can say to that minister that I referred to earlier, you don't have to worry. There's no cloak here, cloaking hatred. This is a real enterprise that is based on something that's just and something that's legitimate. So I say to you all, Salaam Alaikum, Shalom, and in the South African sense, Hamba Gashli, Siyabonga, thank you very much indeed.